From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. According to recent research, fewer people are getting out into nature, fishing, or going to the national parks. At the same time, climate change is raising huge concerns about the planet's future. But can we save the planet if we don't know it, if we don't love it? Today, we'll try to plug back into the natural world. We'll introduce you to a writer who finds rapture in the birds he sees. We'll take you on a shocking tour of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch and find spiritual awakening on the fang of a rattlesnake.
You are in snake territory, and when you're in snake territory, you're supposed to be part of the wild world. So basically, the snake is saying, wake up, people. If you don't, I'm very dangerous.
Sometimes all we have to do is let nature in. Here's a poem from Richard Shelton called Desert Water. Once a year, when infallible toads begin to sing, all the spiders who left me return, and I make room for them. I am too proud to mention their long absence. Then the owls send a message in code from saguaro to saguaro, and the toads stop singing. A sea of warm air rolls over quickly and relaxes. We wait for the promised rain, for the second coming of water. Each time it arrives, like the flood, and I know I have not wasted my life. Spiders still come to my house for shelter. Richard Shelton's poem, Desert Water. Imagine a world without humans. The humans are all gone, wiped out by a global epidemic. Or the rapture, if you prefer. How does the Earth reclaim itself from human civilization? That's the question at the heart of Alan Weisman's speculative science book, The World Without Us. Weisman told Steve Paulson that it wouldn't take long for water to reclaim parts of New York City.
The New York subway system is kind of the underbelly of the city, and when it starts to go, it starts to drag down a lot of things with it. Think of what the island looked like before there was anybody there. It was a forest and it was kind of hilly. The name Manhattan refers to the hills and the rivers and streams that ran between those hills. When the hills were smashed down to superimpose a city grid on top of it, those rivers got buried. So the subway personnel who took me underneath the city showed me that even on a sunny day, they have to pump away about 13 million gallons of groundwater. And if they weren't there maintaining nearly 800 pumps, it's pumping stuff uphill because they are below the water table, the subways would fill within 2 or 3 days. And if there were no one to run emergency pumps, which is what happens now after they have a big rainstorm, within a couple of decades, the columns that are holding up the streets would start to rust, they would start to corrode, they would start to collapse, and the streets would start to cave in, and suddenly there's rivers out there on the surface again.
So New York City itself would actually be quite vulnerable.
Any city would be quite vulnerable. Plants will invade whenever we are not looking. If no one were maintaining the streets, first of all, the sewers would all clog because all these plastic bags that are blowing around, no maintenance people picking them up. No one's raking the leaves. The leaves will fill the streets. Seeds will blow around. They will germinate in the leaf mulch. And then without any firemen, lightning strike will cause a fire, and that will add carbon and nutrients as paper and insulation in the buildings burn. And then the rusting reinforcing bar or girders will start to expand, pop off concrete. That'll add some nice lime to the soil, so the soil will be less acidic. And within a few centuries, we'll have nice mature forests growing among the ruins of our cities.
But realistically, if all of humanity was going to get wiped out, wouldn't a lot of other stuff get wiped out in the process if you're talking about nuclear explosion or something like that?
But I'm not talking about those
I know
things.
You're not. So, yeah. But I mean, it raises the specter of, so what, some virus that might totally wiped out humans, but basically nothing else?
Exactly. Well, here's a good example. AIDS is a virus that only attacks human beings right now. Certain primates carry it, but they are not affected by it. Suppose it were airborne as opposed to, you know, passed by fluids. Suppose bird flu, you know, suddenly really, you know, mutated in a way that we were the primary victims. You know, I dispense with the possibilities within about a paragraph or so. What I'm really interested in is clearing the decks of human beings and all of our distractions so we can see more clearly what else is here, how it would get along without us constantly heaping more stress on it all the time, and also how would it deal with all the stuff we would leave behind, and not just our infrastructure, but all the carbon that we've pumped up, the, you know, smokestacks, our radioactive waste, plastics. But ultimately, the reason for writing this book is for us to see it without us enough so we could see how beautifully nature could and would heal. It has before, after previous extinctions. And then say, yeah, but it's so lovely. Isn't there a way that we could still be a part of this? That's what the book is really about, figuring out what our proper relationship is with nature and how we might achieve that again.
You did a lot of traveling as you were researching this book. What were some of the most interesting places you went?
Well, the Korean Demilitarized Zone certainly stands out. For a writer, it's like walking into a living metaphor. You've got this 2.5-mile-wide strip that bisects the Korean Peninsula since 1953, when the truce was, you know, suspended the Korean War. But you've got two of the world's biggest and most ferocious armies facing each other. I mean, they're in plain sight. They can see each other. Their guns are pointed at each other. They scream at each other through loudspeakers. And yet this strip of land in between has accidentally, no one planned this, reverted into a wilderness that is now one of the most important wildlife refuges in all of Asia. And some of the most precious endangered species take shelter there.
What are some of the animals that are there?
Well, there's the Amur leopard, the one that is most special to me, because I get to see this. It looked like a squadron of military planes in the distance, and then suddenly, in the midst of all these, you know, seething hostilities, this flock of red-crowned cranes, which after the whooping crane is the rarest crane on Earth. And they settle in silently in the midst of all of this stuff. And you know, this is a bird that we've all seen because it's depicted in all Oriental art. You know, this cherry cap and black extremities, and the rest of it is as pure as white can possibly be. And they feed down there, and I saw young red-crowned cranes. They are reproducing, and it's just a magnificent sight. And this is why scientists, including the foundation here in Wisconsin, are trying to convince the two Koreas what a wonderful thing it would be for the world and to bring them closer to each other by making it an international peace park, which I hope happens, because if not, all the suburban development of Seoul, Korea is going to pour in there, or the industrial parks of North Korea. I mean, that's the scenario if the two Koreas unite. That's not so beautiful. Mm-hmm. Or, of course, if there were nobody left on Earth, then all the peninsula would be a peace park.
Yeah. Now, you also went to a vast primeval forest that I'd never heard about. I guess it's between Poland and Belarus.
Yeah. My book starts there. It, you know, just like the authors of Genesis take people back to the Garden of Eden, you know, to paradise, so we can kind of remember our roots. I go to this forest, which is the last remaining fragment of wilderness in Europe. It was preserved by a Lithuanian duke who married the Queen of Poland in the 14th century as a royal hunting preserve. It's about 500,000 acres. And after him, a series of Polish kings and then Russian czars and then eventually all the way up through the Nazis, because Hermann Göring was a big nature fanatic, they kept it as sort of a private little domain. And then it became a national park after World War II. You go in there and you see a lot of the trees that we are accustomed to seeing here, you know, in the northern part of the northern hemisphere. You see this temperate forest, you see these oaks and you see these pines and you see these alders and ash trees, but you have never seen such gigantic versions of them. This is the forest you'd see in your mind's eye when you read Grimm's fairy tales when you're a kid. The interesting thing is, though, it doesn't seem exotic the way the Amazon seems exotic. It seems right, like your body remembers, oh yes, this is the way nature's supposed to be. We were bred to kind of a pale copy you know, the second growth version of these majestic, huge forests. And I really hope that my book is read by everyone in Europe. And fortunately, it's coming out in all those European languages now. So they realize what a treasure they have before the governments of Poland and Belarus keep picking away at it as they've already started, you know, forest managers, professionals, telling nature how it can do it.
Now, I know you didn't write this book to give us morals, but maybe we should have fewer children.
Well, one of the reasons that this book, I think, has received so much attention, and it's very well received because it doesn't preach, it just puts facts out there. At the very end of the book, I do bring up one fact that we have to consider, and as readers have said, you know, this is something I would not have wanted to follow if it was early in the book, but at the end it's so obvious, and that is that every 4 days there's a million more of us on the planet. So I do another thought experiment at the end of the book. It's not something that I'm very comfortable with. I don't think any one of us would be comfortable with this notion. But the experiment is, instead of imagining suddenly a world where there are no human beings, let's imagine a world where human beings get to stay. But instead, each time, each family that procreates only does it once. You know, every woman only has one child. What would happen? Well, it took me a while to find someone to run the numbers. The zero population growth movement is gone in the United States for political reasons. They changed their name to something else, but it's not very recognizable, frankly. And in Europe, I found demographic institutes, though, that were very interested in this question. It turns out that at the end of the 19th century, there were 1.6 billion people on the planet. At the end of the 20th century, 6.6 billion people on the planet. We're headed to 9 billion people. If we reduced our procreation and there were only one child per family, within a century, we'd go back to 1.6 billion people. We're going to have to do some things in order to survive, and we're going to have to make some hard decisions, and I think the population issue has to be on the table. So that's the one thing that I raise in this book. Everybody else is talking about all the different ways we should be recycling and we should be using energy more efficiently. I've written about that previously. This book basically was to let us see how beautiful our planet would be from the perspective of us not being in the way, and then figure out, you know, what could we do that might let us stay here.
You mentioned the atmosphere. What about climate, global climate? How would that change if humans disappeared?
If we stopped sending carbon up the smokestack tomorrow, no more exhaust pipes, according to the atmospheric scientists that I've talked to, it'd probably take about 100,000 years for all the carbon that we have dug out of the ground, you know, that energy that nature didn't need anymore, so nature buried it. The energy in the exhaust has now packed the atmosphere with more carbon dioxide than this planet has seen since nearly 700,000 years ago, and things were a lot more tropical around here. The 100,000 years that it would take for it to be reabsorbed by the oceans, by the biological systems, by actually the geology itself, most of it would really occur during the first 1,000 years. Turnovers of the ocean would help absorb an awful lot of carbon dioxide. And so within the first few 100 years, you'd start to see a noticeable difference, I guess. I mean, you know, we're starting to notice that plant regimes are changing, that we have longer growing seasons than we used to have. But it's hard to say. You know, there are many different models for what this means because of the number, the amount of carbon we've put into the atmosphere. The future is kind of a moving target. So at a certain point in the book where I talk about different scenarios of climate change, I have to give a few different options. A warmer New York, for example, that forest that comes back might not be the one that Henry Hudson saw. It might be have palmettos and magnolias. Could it be that all that warming will melt the Greenland ice cap to the point that it'll dump enough cold fresh water to slow down the ocean or stop the ocean conveyor? Will we have some kind of ice age or freeze in Europe and east coast of the United States? If so, then maybe we'll have a tundra. Could those things possibly cancel each other out? There are even some models that look at that possibility, in which case maybe we will continue to have oaks and beeches and some of the trees that we are familiar with. Every year, of course, has been surprising recently.
Alan Wiseman is a journalist from Massachusetts. He's the author of The World Without Us. Steve Paulson spoke with him. doesn't look like the human race is going anywhere soon. So a quick fix for the world's environmental problems isn't around the corner. With a daily list of alarming news headlines, melting polar ice, extinctions, catastrophic weather, it can be hard to have hope. Anne Strainchamps wonders if the coming generations will curse us for making a big mess and leaving it for someone else to clean up. As a mom, it's something she worries about a lot.
One of the worst moments in my parenting life was the night a few years ago when we all sat down as a family to watch An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's depressing movie about global environmental devastation. Somewhere around the time the icebergs melted and the baby polar bears began drowning, my 9-year-old son, who still occasionally slept with a beloved stuffed polar bear, stood up and shot Al Gore a look of pure loathing. "If he thinks everything's so bad, why doesn't he just commit suicide?" he yelled, then stomped upstairs. I felt awful. Kids his age are still falling in love with this beautiful blue planet, and we tell them it's terminally ill? By the next morning, of course, Nicky was mostly annoyed that he'd skipped playing video games to watch a stupid documentary, but I worried, then and for a long time afterwards, that he might have lost a bit of what should be every child's birthright, faith in the future, that tingly, brand-new morning feeling, the excitement of knowing that the sun is rising on them and their lives in a world filled with hope and possibility. Then, a couple of weeks ago, I went to help his fourth-grade class with a school project.
Well, this is my law office. It's called Ethnicity Law Office. And of course I made it. And as you see, I have a solar panel up here and a rooftop garden up there.
It has a giant glass dome on top, which is a greenhouse, and a reclaimed wood door.
It uses LED lights. It has solar panels. It's going to have a rain barrel.
Picture a class of 26 fourth graders building the future out of cardboard boxes, construction paper, and glue. They're working on a miniature scale model of a city, their vision of a sustainable, green community. It's got tiny solar panels made of toothpicks and tinfoil, little rain barrels made out of paper cups, roof gardens constructed from bits of old carpeting. It's even got a name.
Ethnicity. Miss McClintock came up with it, but we liked it because ethnicity. The runner-up was Greentopia. It was a combination of green and utopia, because utopia is the perfect place to live, but Greentopia would be the perfect green place to live.
And what do these 10-year-olds want in their perfect city?
This is an alternative energy store, and it sells like wind turbines and rain barrels and solar panels, etc., etc.
I build a plant museum in the Tower of Pancakes. The Tower of Pancakes is for people in the morning and people in the afternoon and sometimes at dinner if they want some pancakes or sausage.
Mine's a shoe store for people to get shoes. And it's called Shoes for Yous. It's sort of catchy.
We have a beauty salon called
African American Hair Specialist. We have unique hairstyles, and we have solar panels, and we use water barrels so we can use the water over and over again to wash people's hair and stuff like that. And it's a really fun place to be, and you can get your kids and they play outside in the backyard.
So the future these kids are building is looking pretty good. And when they get to working on their layout, I'm even more impressed. When I've been to my share of town planning meetings, and they aren't nearly this positive or this polite.
In our plan, it shows a huge sidewalk and a place for buses and bikes to get through. Yeah. And in there, there's like scarcely enough room for just the green space.
We should move some of those buildings back.
Yeah.
Shouldn't we put like some solar panels and stuff on the top?
Yeah, it's not done yet.
Just wondering. Yeah, James, and we could paint like on the side hybrid.
But what if they're not to scale?
Just for Henry, but you have to say it.
But this is what
happens. You have to raise your hand.
Who votes that we move the nature center over to here?
Majority.
Okay.
Listening to these kids work, seeing how energetic and confident and happy they are, made me realize something that I do know but tend to forget, the importance of hope, without which very little in this world ever gets accomplished. Rachel Carson, the environmentalist who warned the world about the dangers of DDT, had every reason to feel hopeless herself, but she wrote once that if she could give one gift to every child born in the world, it would be a sense of wonder, so indestructible that it would last throughout life, an unfailing antidote against the boredom and disenchantment of later years. So what I wish for my son and his classmates is this, that they hold on to their confidence in their ability to build the sustainable future they dream of, and that they remember to have a good time doing it.
Anne Strainchamps is a producer and interviewer on To the Best of Our Knowledge. She went looking for hope among the children of Randall Elementary School in Madison, Wisconsin. Coming up, a writer finds rapture on the wing of a bird.
The secret about birders is that they live in an alternative universe. Birders are people who live in an enchanted world.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
In contrast to the Calvinism that shaped my psyche to be anxious and striving, an easy grace descended on me whenever I escaped the embrace of my loving family. All I had to do was take a short walk down Wilson Avenue, past my grandmother's house, cross Court Street, and duck under the fence that enclosed the endless acres of Maryville College Woods. Once inside, all thoughts of God and Jesus and all need for salvation vanished, and for hours I was in a state of natural grace.
That's Sam Keen reading from his book Sightings, Extraordinary Encounters with Ordinary Birds. When Keen was a young boy, he discovered the glorious world of birds during those walks in the woods. As he grew older, he realized that his religion, if he still had any, was to be found in nature, especially in the birds he came across, whether a red-headed woodpecker, a brown thrasher, or a ruby-throated hummingbird. Steve Paulson recently sat down with Keen to talk about how we can find moments of wonder in the natural world.
Now, one of the things that's so wonderful about reading your descriptions of birds is that, for you, I have the sense that, at certain moments at least, this is kind of the way you can enter a different realm, a sacred realm. And you quote the philosopher Wittgenstein, who said, "There are things that cannot be put into words. They make themselves manifest. They are what is mystical."
Yeah. And I think that's really the secret of this book. There's a very real way in which it isn't about birds at all. It's about epiphanies. It's about the way that the world meets us when we are willing to go toward it with open hearts and open eyes and to wonder. And I think it's the best-kept secret in the United States. You know, there are more people who go a-birding than there are who do NASCAR races or NFL. But mostly they're in the closet. And I think they're in the closet because they don't have a way to explain to other people who don't have this enthusiasm what it's all about. And the secret about birders is that they live in an alternative universe. You know, philosophers have made a great deal of the fact of how increasingly since the Industrial Revolution, the world has become disenchanted and that the sense of the sacred has disappeared from the world. That's not true for birders. Birders are people who live in an enchanted world.
When you talk about sacred, what do you mean by that word?
Well, a sense of reverence. A sense that life is a gift, a sense that meaning comes to us, that we don't always have to invent it by our work, a sense of grace. It's a very old set of feelings, but a set of feelings that, for the most part, we don't experience too much when we get as we are, you know, way, way, way too busy and we're multitasking. And like I say, you know, in the 60s, we had this saying, "Be here now." Well, now we have a saying, "Be elsewhere always." Everybody's involved with virtual realities and their head is in a screen or in an iPod or something else. And so we miss this sense of the sacredness of the environment.
You have a great story in your book about the moment when you kind of shifted your focus from only caring about rare birds to so-called ordinary birds. It sounds like a rather dramatic moment for you.
Well, it was. You know, I was living then in Boaz, Alabama, and the whole town was inundated almost with English sparrows. And so down in the main street of town, they would hire these people to come out with shotguns and kill English sparrows. And they killed so many of them that they would just put them in piles and the garbage men come pick them up. And so, you know, I participated in that. I had a slingshot, and I would go out and shoot at English sparrows. I was pretty good at it, you know. I killed a lot of English sparrows and didn't think anything of it. They were just trash birds, you know. They were lesser species that we could eliminate. And then one day I was in the front yard, supposed to be mowing the lawn, but I was really practicing with my slingshot, and I saw a bird just fly over my head, and I just let loose with my slingshot and hit it. And it fell at my feet dead. And I picked it up, and it was a yellow-bellied sapsucker, a rare bird, a bird I hadn't seen. And suddenly I was just, I don't know, I was kind of horrified and had this great sense of guilt. And as I began to think about that, I began to realize that I couldn't just go wantonly killing species because they were, quote, ordinary, that every different kind of life form has its own love of its life.
Well, speaking of common birds, you write about the wood thrush, and you have a particularly wonderful passage about how it sings. Could you read that?
Yes, okay. The song of the wood thrush, or bell bird as it is sometimes known, is so haunting that bird lovers have gone to extremes to describe it. The wood thrush's song belongs to a family of experiences that usher us into the threshold where sound trails off into silence, and time disappears into timelessness, and the known world is engulfed by some great mystery. This family of sound includes the reverberating echo of a temple bell that dwindles off into the void, the polyphonic chanting of Tibetan monks that merges into an endless communal chorus, the electric interval between the crash of thunder and the flash of lightning, the deep sigh and profound calm that comes in meditation when the mind finally stops chattering, the timeless moment before sleep or after awaking when we enter a dream world in which it seems perfectly reasonable that we should fly, change gender, or simultaneously be ourselves and our parents. The proper name for this experience of unknowing is not mysticism, but wisdom. When Socrates was told that the oracle of Delphi said he was the wisest man in Greece, he replied that that could only mean that he did not know. Wisdom is the paradoxical art of seeing in the dark. There are no wood thrushes in the sparsely wooded area of California where I live now, but there are great horned owls aplenty. And when they begin their low, uncanny hooting just after dusk, I am transported back to an earlier time when I sat quietly at the threshold, listening to the thrush's invitation to evensong, unknowing, amazed.
I love that idea of these threshold moments when there just can be some little thing that happens, often when you're out in the woods, out in nature, that can shift you in some profound way.
Yeah. I talk in here about how the Greeks had two senses of time, chronos, which is the kind of time that we live in mostly in our society. It's clock time, minute after minute. It's always, you know, running out, and the time in which we never have time or leisure to do anything. And then there's kairos, and kairos is that moment when things break in upon us. And like in Ecclesiastes, unto everything there's a time and a season to everything under the sun. Time, you know, to gather stones, time to throw them away, a time to make love, a time to make war, all of that. And it's when those modes change that we get in touch, I think, with the sacred quality of our lives.
Now, we've been talking about how birds, for you, have often been this kind of entree into this other sense of time, into this sacred time. And it's easy to understand that with lots of birds, but there are some birds that are not so lovable, like the turkey vulture, for instance, which you describe as low-class birds, a sort of flying mafia that controls a far-flung waste management empire. I guess I have to ask, have you come to appreciate turkey vultures?
I do appreciate turkey vultures because I have a compost pile on my farm, and I put all kinds of things there, including meat scraps and things that you shouldn't put in compost. And I put it there because the vultures come there and sit up on the posts and come down and raid the compost pile. And when it's not being raided by the crows, but the crows come down, you know, like a malevolent caucus, and they and they sort of test to see whether they like what's there or not. They're very particular. No, but the vultures are wonderful. They, first place, if you ever see vultures sunning their wings, when the weather is cold or been wet, they'll come up and sit on the very top of one of my trees and spread their wings out and just bathe the mouth. My little farm in Sonoma is right on the Agua Caliente watershed, and so the wind comes up that watershed and creates these thermals. So the vultures, as well as the supposedly mostly red-tailed hawk, come up there, and you know they just ride those thermals all day long, and then they'll start swooping down. You see the way that they feather their wings, and it's really quite remarkable. When did I abandon the rich soundscape that called to me in childhood? The quack, chirp, whinny, bark, whine, bleat, mew, cackle, honk, hoot, and warble of birds, the whisper or howl of the winds, the splash or swoosh of falling water. When was the last time I fell asleep listening intently to the lullaby of the cicada, or the sound of soft rain on a tin roof? And why did I cease listening? Most modern people, like myself, are in danger of becoming prisoner in Plato's cave, a captive in a virtual reality, brainwashed by a barrage of data, emails, messages, spam. I am inundated by profane language. I live and move in a mediascape that's constantly hawking merchandise, ideologies, and gospels that promise easy happiness and cheap grace. The noise to information ratio grows every day. The noise to knowledge ratio is unimaginable. The noise to wisdom ratio is beyond calculation. In addition, there's the everyday cacophony of automobile horns, airplanes, cell phones ringing, fire engines, ambulances, police sirens, boom boxes, jackhammers, and occasional bombs bursting in air. It's difficult to estimate the toll the profane soundscape has taken on us. Listening is rapidly becoming a lost art.
Sam Keen, reading an excerpt from his book Sightings, Extraordinary Encounters with Ordinary Birds. He talked with Steve Paulson. What's your most extraordinary natural encounter? Let us know at ttbook.org. The Pacific Gyre is a region in the middle of the Pacific Ocean that is much calmer than you'd expect. And that's because all the major currents swirl around it, leaving the middle untouched. Unfortunately, the gyre collects waste, like a toilet that never flushes, since any debris that floats into it can't be carried away. That's why it's been dubbed the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. The gyre's dirty reputation drew the attention of Thomas Morton, a writer for Vice magazine. He took a journey out to the gyre, expecting an island of garbage, but he found a sea of plastic instead.
I'd been reading about the gyre for a while, and it would just kind of come up every so often as almost as sort of like a news of the weird story. It wasn't it was rarely presented in a very serious context for me. Just this big, what I assumed was this big mound of trash out there, free-floating in the ocean. And so we got in touch with the person who discovered all this trash, Captain Charles Moore, and kind of signed up to be half the crew on the ship on this expedition. We went out in September of 2007. The few times I've been on boats before this, I got mercilessly sick. So it was a bit, I don't know, it took a little bit of internal coaxing. And it took a really hearty dose of scopolamine intravenously, which helped quell the nausea as I went out there. If you feel like you're out just like feet from shore on a lake, because it's extremely still out there, it's pretty eerie. We hadn't seen like boats or really much of anything for a couple days. And so we got out there and we were expecting kind of like we're gonna end up there and it was gonna look like this, you know, just cartoon of total pollution, but that's not what it was. It was just, we started seeing more and more little pieces of crap float by. We'd see like we pulled out a birthday balloon, a lot of little like Coke bottles, water bottles, and that kind of thing. And just as we passed this little perimeter, there started being more and more until there was like a near constant stream of it. And a lot of the pieces of plastic we were picking up had, like a lot of the soap bottles and stuff, had Japanese writing on it. It had clearly come from Asia. And we were very far from California. We were even further from Japan and Korea and stuff, which is where we kind of guessed a lot of the stuff was coming from. Now, some of it comes off boats. I mean, that, there's like sort of a logic in that. You'd think they're crossing the Pacific from Japan to California or to Washington or wherever. Stuff falls off the boat. Obviously, it's going to fall off in the middle of it. Like, captain's not going to go and try to like pick up his soap bottles or whatever. But the estimates say that like seaborne trash only accounts for about a fifth of it. Most of what we're finding is stuff that's been either put in landfills or just tossed on the side and has ended up like washing out into rivers and streams and then emptying out into the ocean. What we thought was going to be the most boring part of the trip was the science-y part. We were taking these water samples to test the levels to see what the ratio is of plastic particles to zooplankton in the water. And you look out into the water and the water looks perfectly clear, but then you pull up a trawl of it. It's only been out for a few minutes, and it looks like a snow globe. It's just filled with tiny broken down pieces of plastic that you can't see from the surface. And what we realized that the plastic out in this little area outweighs kind of the natural content of the water, the organic content, by a base ratio of about like 6 to 1. And that's, we'd pull in samples that were upwards of several hundred or 1,000 to 1 that are basically just all plastic, no plant life or anything. The reason that that plastic's there is regular garbage, organic waste, when it breaks down, eventually mineralizes, it decomposes into the component elements of it that kind of like either are eaten or seep back into the environment somehow. When plastic breaks down, it often breaks down into like smaller parts of the same material. So when a Coke bottle gets like totally sunbaked and degrades, it's not disappearing, it's just turning into like tiny little minute particles of said Coke bottle that then spread out over a far greater area. One thing we noticed when we were taking in the samples is you get to a certain point and then you stop seeing smaller particles. You get particles that go down to about like a millimeter in, say, diameter or so, and then there's nothing. You don't get like tiny, tiny, tiny little dust pieces. And that's because once they get past a certain point, they are small enough to enter the feeding holes of jellyfish and other filter feeders. And I mean, these animals work by like non-discriminate feeding. They just like suck in water and take in whatever it's got in it. So if it's got, it doesn't matter if it's got plankton or if it's got like little tiny pieces of a big pin, that's what ends up in its system. And as it builds up there, these jellyfish move on to other waters. They get eaten by fish. Those fish get eaten by other fish, and the whole time this plastic isn't being digested, it's building up inside the digestive tracts of these animals. And eventually it makes its way back to us. We eat the larger fish, and so we're eating our own waste. which is kind of a ugly enough implication on its own, but what's worse than that is that when the jellyfish take in these particles, they're taking in oftentimes like all the chemicals they've been sitting in too. It just sops them up. And then as the particles build up, as you go up the food chain, so do all these toxins. Most of these pollutants are on our radar because they're, if not known, then suspected carcinogens. The effects that these chemicals can have, studies link them to a suite of diseases that kind of reads like just a list of the public health crises in the United States over the last 20 years. Things like obesity, attention deficit disorder, liver cancer, early onset diabetes. I mean, this is all stuff that's still being researched, but even if it's kind of right on one of these counts, you know, we're in hot water. I'm not a very kind of environmentally conscious person. I was a little more interested in the kind of sensational aspect of this going out into the water. At the same time, I never really thought much about the ocean, but going out here, as soon as we started seeing the garbage, as soon as we started seeing the particle waste, like it really built up and felt very heavy. Like we realized that this wasn't just like kind of an Earth Day matter. This wasn't just litter on the highway. This is an issue that has horrible, horrible implications for not only the planet, but our species in particular. It felt like, I don't know, it felt like staring down the barrel of a gun and realizing it had been there without our realizing it for half a century at least.
Thomas Morton wrote about the Pacific Gyre for Vice magazine. You can find links to his article and pictures of the gyre on our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, life after a rattlesnake bite.
I actually talk to snakes. I tell them, you know, you can't come back here. If you come back here, I've got kids. And if you're in my front yard again because I know who you are right now, I may have to kill you. Because that's a fact. You can't become a home for a rattlesnake.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Eric Toso is used to looking closely at life for its lessons, but he wasn't used to looking closely enough at the ground beneath his feet. One night, Toso was bitten by a rattlesnake. The experience changed his life and his relationship with the natural world. Toso writes about the bite and its aftermath in the memoir Zero at the Bone. He told Anne Strange Shimps what happened the night of his bite.
We were walking back to the house, and I felt a couple of needles go into the side of my foot.
Did you know what it was right away?
I didn't have a clue. I don't know if you've ever had this experience when something happens and you have no frame of reference for it. And I didn't have a frame of reference for walking in the dark and getting zapped on the foot. And the rattlesnake did not rattle.
How long before you realized it was a snake? Did you see the snake?
It was one of these moments where the brain went into kind of a search mode. It's like, oh, hard drive, you know, what's going on here? And I remember the sequence of thoughts, and one of them was, I walked into a prickly pear, because I do know what that feels like, and it felt kind of like prickly pear spines. And then I'm considering that possibility, and I gradually eliminate it and say, no, there's no prickly pears here, because this is a path, and unless I'm off the path. And then I thought, oh, you know, one of my neighbors has cleaned up some barbed wire and dropped it here and forgotten it, and I walked into it. And then I'm thinking, no, that's not really likely. And as I'm running through these possibilities, then I hear, you know, both my sons heard it and immediately they ran around me, which was kind of dangerous, and sprinted to the house. And it's, you know, one of them was saying, Papa's been bitten by a rattlesnake, Papa's been bitten by a rattlesnake. And they ran into the house and, you know, then it was just all hell broke loose. Immediately, I'd say within a couple of seconds, I didn't want to step on my foot. So I hopped. I hopped the remaining 50 feet or so up to the house. And just kind of took stock for a second, and I looked down, and I had these two blood spots on the side of my foot. then it just started to really roll. I just can't tell you, even thinking about it right now. I would not wish a rattlesnake on any living, sentient being because it is a excruciatingly painful experience.
Okay, because it sounded, at first, it didn't sound that bad. It sounded like maybe a really, really bad bee sting. But, so at some point it became truly a horrific form of pain.
Yes, and what happens is snake venom digests tissue. It's made up of all kinds of nasty proteolytic enzymes and glycoproteins and da-da-da-da-da. And it's quite a cocktail, and it goes after certain kinds of tissue. It absolutely loves circulatory tissue and goes after nervous tissue, breaks down connective tissue, goes after muscle tissue. I mean,
it's basically eating you from the inside.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much you are being liquefied. I mean, I think that's the best way to put it. it is kind of awful. And, you know, I felt like I was taken over.
You write that after you called 911 and the ambulance people came and you were still coherent and everything, but at some point, really, you moved into a whole different space. And I think you write that when you were in the ambulance and beginning to crash, you felt like death came and sat with you for a while.
Yeah, and what this is it's kind of like life being extinguished slowly. You know, it's like when you take this little bell-shaped thing and go over a candle and you extinguish the candle. It felt like whatever it is that is life force was retreating, you know, and it was retreating back into the core of my body. And that what was happening was that whatever death is was pushing it, you know, back into this small space. I thought that I would be afraid, and I was actually surprised that what I felt was a kind of surrender and just calm. And it's like, okay, if this is it, this is it.
You write that it got even better than that. there's a description you write of being in the hospital, in the ICU, and at which point you were kind of fighting for your life. I mean, this was a huge rattlesnake bite, and it could have killed you easily. And you write that you wound up in a kind of euphoria.
And this is something that, you know, I have some cynical friends and they say, well, duh, you know, they're giving you painkillers, morphine and other stuff. Of course you're going to feel euphoric. And I understand that and I'll concede that, okay, you know, there was this painkilling element, but there's this other piece and I'm going to just try to explain this a little bit. My attention shifted from a kind of noisy view of time that's, you know, worried about the past, worried about the future, kind of looking at life cross-eyed and saying, it's not the way I want it. Why do I have to work so hard? Anyway, it's just like there's this chatter, you know, that I'm going to call this kind of like this runaway, complaining, noisy chatter.
Yeah, I think we're all familiar with that.
Yeah, yeah. And anyway, my attention shifted away from that to a kind of here and now resonance. And this resonance was so perfect in a way that life, even if it was going out, was precious and something to be revered and something to be thoroughly digested and enjoyed and graciously honored.
And so as bad as this was to be slammed right into the present, you actually found it to be deeply pleasurable.
I would say that there are moments in life that are traumatic, that actually contain within them a kind of blessing or gift that is a kind of teacher.
So did you begin to see what had happened to you in a kind of mythological way?
I was assaulted by people talking about the snake. I mean, even when I was in the hospital, one of my friends snuck in because the nurses weren't allowing people in, and he snuck in. You know, he just said, I had to come see you. You know, I heard you were bitten by a snake and da-da-da-da. And I'm thinking, you know, would he have come in to see me if I was in a car accident? You know, and I really think he wouldn't have. But there was something about a snake, not only the snake, but the snake in my front yard. You know, it's like, here is the most threatening, dangerous piece of nature, you know, and it's in the front yard. And it attacked or it defended itself or whatever. It struck, and it struck home that close to the secure place. I think this triggered almost like this panic or psychological response, and it wasn't just my friends. It was like across Tucson, because I wrote an article for the newspaper, and I got so many responses. You know, the rational part of me is thinking, look, statistically, rattlesnakes are about the least dangerous thing in this city. We have, you know, huge problems with car accidents. We've got execution-style killing and drug rings, and, you know, there's pathogens in the air. There are things that we eat and drink that are causing problems. And it's like the really dangerous stuff just sort of got pushed aside. But this very unlikely thing that does have this connection to, like, an innate hardwiring triggered this incredible response. I don't know if this is helpful at all, but it's almost like, you know, maybe the snakes were out there in the desert and they said, okay, you know, we need kind of an advocate. You know, who shall we get? And it's like, okay, well, there's a whole stable of writers over there. It looks like let's just pick one of them and, you know, zap him and see if he can, you know, come out and tell the truth about us. And it's like, okay, there he is, get him. And then the story just goes on.
And do you feel like you've become an advocate for the snake?
I actually do. I have since seen many rattlesnakes, and some of them have been really mad at me because I relocate them. But I feel a kind of affinity with them, if one can have an affinity for a reptile that, you know, has infrared vision and, you know, sees through pits in its snout and just has a totally different perspective on the desert than I do. But yes, I feel a kind of kinship or maybe brotherhood.
Eric Toser lives in Tucson, Arizona, with his wife and two sons. His memoir is Zero at the Bone. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him. Before we leave you to step out your front door into the world, here is a poem from James Wright called I Try to Waken and Greet the World Once Again. In a pine tree, a few yards away from my windowsill, a brilliant blue jay is springing up and down, on a branch. I laugh as I see him abandon himself to entire delight, for he knows as well as I do that the branch will not break. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. Send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program In Living Color, number 413A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Mike Ewing, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Anne Strainchamps, and Doug Gordon. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.